From APR, American Public Radio.
Welcome to Dialogue, a program that explores the world of ideas and issues in national and international affairs, history, and culture. I'm George Liston C.A. We are all in this together. That somewhat shopworn expression pretty well sums up the range of economic challenges facing our society. Whether the problem is increasing personal growth and productivity in the workplace, or equipping the unemployed with skills useful in today's workforce, the task is critically important. One thing is certain. New and imaginative approaches are desperately needed. To discuss some new thinking on education and employment, I'm pleased to welcome educator and author Peter Klein to Dialogue. And Peter, welcome to Dialogue.
Thank you, George. It's good to be here.
It's great to have you, Peter. And indeed, you are at the cutting edge of things I think are very important to our society. You know, Peter, central to your approach in helping people both work better and then also find a place in the modern workforce is the notion of integrated learning. And I think we'd all be well served by starting out with that. And briefly put, precisely what do you mean by that?
Well, there are two ways of getting at that. It's an extraordinarily complex and also simple concept. Complexity is based on very simple things elaborating themselves. The first thing to say is that the way we learn our native language is fundamentally different from the way that we are introduced to concepts in the classroom. And if we study the process that children go through and learning a native language, we can learn a great deal about how to present information and how to communicate about information in the adult world. And that's because our brains are genetically designed to do certain kinds of things. And that leads to the second point, which is that we work in integrative learning with a number of different brain models. The one easiest to talk about is the seven intelligences model of Howard Gardner. And what he's saying is that we have not one but seven different types of intelligence in our brains. I'd like to focus on one of them very briefly. A very important intelligence that we all have is the bodily kinesthetic intelligence. We all think with our bodies. And this thinking with our bodies is extremely important in how we deal with particularly the world of manufacturing, how we do many of the things that are important to us. It is almost non-existent in the academic classroom.
That's interesting to me. You know, Peter, the word that occurs to me as I listen to you is natural.
Yeah.
It seems to me that what you're really striving for with integrated learning is the most natural approach, the approach that uses the way we are.
Exactly.
To advance the way we should learn.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Because I was thinking about what Deming said about systems and how it is never the fault of the individual, it's always the fault of the system when something goes wrong. And systems, of course, are built from people, and so there's an interaction between the people and the systems. If the systems are extremely oriented toward information flowing from the top down, then you get a kind of person that is not able to take responsibility.
In other words, the more hierarchical, the less comfortable for the individual.
Yes. Mm. And we were evolved through billions of years of evolution to be extremely responsible for our interaction with the environment as individuals. We can do that in the workplace, and we can use a great deal more intelligence in just about any job than we're usually given credit for.
Peter, I find this, I must confess, immensely stimulating. Let me ask you this, because I like the way you introduced the individual and then talked briefly about systems, focusing on systems for a minute. I know another phrase that's key to you, in fact, it's the subject of your most recent book, is the learning culture, viewing the workplace as a learning culture. Now, deriving from what you've said already, what do you mean by this learning culture in the workplace?
What I don't mean is that it's an institution in which people learn. What I mean is something like the banding of people together to form something like an organism which learns above and beyond the individuals in it, that the system, the structure that is developed, fosters the institution as a whole being able to learn and remember and innovate. Hmm. And that's becoming extremely important with the rapid changes in the economy and the world markets, that General Motors or whatever must be able to make sudden changes in what it does, and it must respond as an intelligent being.
You know, what I'd like to do with you right now, Peter, is sort of using our imagination, walk into the workplace. Let me put it this way. How important is a harmonious and productive workplace? And what's the, I know you list a number of factors, but what would you say are some of the major reasons we don't have more of them?
I think that the biggest reason is the way that the industrial economy evolved with scientific management, with using people as machines at a time when we didn't have automation. And that has outstayed its welcome, because now with automation we require almost every worker to be extremely intelligent and extremely creative and resourceful, using complex equipment and performing constantly changing tasks. So when you had people who were simply cogs in the machine, the harmony of the workforce didn't matter as much. I think it mattered, but I think it could be ignored. Today, it's an economic issue of enormous significance. Is there harmony in the workplace? Are people thinking together? Are they being creative together? Do they welcome each other's company? Do they love to solve problems together?
Right.
If you have that atmosphere, it makes an enormous difference. I've been told by people in workplaces, they say, one man said to me, our company is unusually good. It's 10% efficient.
Really?
Yes.
And that was considered unusually good by him?
He said most of them are 5% efficient.
That's extraordinary.
But when you see what happens, you know, when you move from a workplace where people are barely talking to each other and don't look at you as you walk down the hall, to one where people have a ferment going on among them. One place you could see this is in Tracy Kidder's book, The Soul of a New Machine, where there was this tremendous excitement among all these people building these computers and communication among each other. That's what you want everywhere.
I would think so. You know, I know one of the things you bring on early in 10 Steps as one of the reasons that we don't have this kind of creativity, this kind of liberation of the individual, is fear.
Fear, yes.
You mentioned fear, and I'd love for you to tell us a bit about that. Fear of accountability, I guess fear of responsibility. Fear.
Yes. Deming said the first responsibility is to drive out fear.
Yeah.
There's a biological reason for that. In the structure of the brain, we downshift from our neocortex into our reptilian brain when we enter a fear situation. We can no longer think. And you can see this if you're suddenly about to be in an automobile accident and you freeze up. That's what the brain is doing. It's looking for an automatic response. What we need now is the ability to be extremely resourceful and to work with situations that were previously seen as threats, as opportunities. If the market changes, it's an opportunity for your company to grow and develop new products.
Well, Peter, you know, I think you brought us to the point where the obvious question is, okay, that's a superb analysis, and I quite honestly think it is. How do you get beyond it? You've got 10 steps listed in the book, but how does a company begin the process of reversing this? And I think communication might have something to do with this.
It does, because what we found is the assessment is the first step. There has to be an agreement among all the people in the organization of how different people think differently. There are illusions. Management will say the workers don't, or they won't, or they, you know, and you go and talk to the workers, it's not true. They have illusions about each other that are false. When these illusions are cleared up, when people find out what's really true of each other, they can be totally in disagreement, but at least they know what the disagreement is.
Right.
Only then can you begin to set up a discussion and communication about what's going on.
You know, it seems to me, Peter, in listening to you and after having read the books that you've written, and I must add that you've written on extensively on education for children as well as this, that one theme runs throughout all of it, I think, and in this discussion as well. It's a kind of a liberation of the individual. I mean, insofar as I hope I get it correctly,
yes.
That you're trying to sort of release potential within the person that he or she might not even have recognized or might have been constrained by the structure.
You see, I believe that every human being is born with the capacity to accomplish so much more than life ever draws out of us, that it doesn't matter who it is. It doesn't matter what their previous record is. That the biggest waste in the world today is the waste of human potential. It's millions of times what it should be.
I want to bring into our conversation a couple of the techniques and expressions you use in this. There are quite a few, and unfortunately we don't have time for all of them, but here are a couple that really just leapt out at me. This one I found just so astounding, and yet it's such a simple and direct idea, the notion of continuous improvement.
If my concern for operating the equipment in this particular factory is as great as it would be if I were going to perform a piece by Mozart in a concert hall, then I will continuously improve. And I've talked to people over and over again who are doing this. We can get the time it takes to repair this machine down from 2 hours to 10 minutes. That's continuous improvement, and that's creative, and it's exciting.
Yeah.
And when you get teams operating that way, they develop a kind of interaction that is so exciting to be a part of, mm-hmm. that it goes home with them. It affects how they relate to their children and their spouses.
You know, Peter, something just occurred to me. In a society, as I think we might both agree, that is so geared to the competitive, where's the competition in this? I mean, what's the individual competing with?
Individual, Yasha Heifetz said, I compete with myself. Yeah. That makes sense. I am continually competing with myself. It doesn't make sense for me to compete with anyone else. I want to know what other people are doing. I want to respect what they're doing. I don't want to try to replicate it. That's not me. And even in what seem to be the most routine tasks, each person will do it differently. Let them find their own best way and let them improve that constantly. Then within the organization, let's get rid of competition. Let's have teamwork. As large organizations compete with each other, that's healthy because it produces continuous improvement worldwide in everything.
Yeah.
So it's a wonderful stimulation. I don't see any problem with that kind of competition, and it's here to stay. But as I relate to you in this conversation, or as I relate to you in the workplace, it should always be, how can we assist each other to have a richer experience, to do more?
Richer experience, that keys another question of mine. And I'd like to give a kind of a sense, or draw from you a sense of how Peter Klein's ideas work in sort of a day-to-day way in the workplace. And let me introduce here another phrase from the book, the good and new. And this, as I understand it, is kind of a technique whereby people give accounts of themselves or some activity that is honest. I think that's one of the first principles, but also positive. Now, take it from there. What is the good and new, and what does it do?
You got it. It's that simple. And what it does is it shifts the tendency that is part of our culture to be down on everything. You know, the evening bad news as opposed to the evening news. The focus in sitcoms on things always going wrong. It is a chance for people to learn experientially that things are going well in their lives. Even if everything is terrible, there's something that's going well. And that is not to denigrate looking at what's wrong. It is to say, let's take the energy of what's going right and use that. And as groups start to do that, the transformation is unbelievable. As we said at the beginning, complex things come from very, very simple principles. And by introducing the good and new as a ritual in any group, we find a tremendous transformation in the amount of creativity that comes from that alone. And people will usually be very surprised by that, yeah. because it's so simple.
You know, I'd love for you, Peter, to expand on that just a bit, because I think one of the points that I derive from the book as well is that you almost anticipate people saying, well, Peter Klein, that's all well and good, but isn't that a bit of a Pollyannish approach? Why would you react to that kind of charge?
I would say that we're Pollyannish on the other side. We've managed to find something wrong with everything, and I think as we sit here and talk, the political situation in Washington is a good example of that right now. Let's be realistic, and let's be critical, and let us say that the ultimate skill in criticism is to say what's good,
yeah.
and to say that truthfully and accurately. And when I start with groups and ask them to do things like, what's good in your life, or what do you respect about this other person that you work with? I get very, very slim answers at first. There's very little experience that people have in talking this way. With experience, they learn to go on for hours. And that's a critical skill that needs to be developed. It's a basic form of intelligence, to be able to see how things are going right and how we can improve them, because most of evolution has been based on the successes of the past. The failures drop out of the picture. And as we evolve our society, we want to build on successes, not kill them before they have a chance to get going.
You've touched on this, but I'd like you to say a bit more about it, because implicit in the book, in your thinking, and into this conversation, is a statement, perhaps a judgment, about American society. And I will use this phrase, and I'm not sure, it may have picked it up from you, I'll give you credit for it if I have, but the feeling I have from reading you is that you think that as a society we've come pretty close to perfecting the art of the put-down. and becoming overly critical? And if I'm correct in that, what are the costs of that beyond the workplace, even in the way we relate?
Well, let's go to the schoolroom. Let's go to the fourth grader, and the teacher says, "Did you really write this, or did you copy it?" And the student who really wrote it never writes again, because the implication is, you're not smart enough to write something this good. You must have copied it. And it's that kind of constant battering that we get all through school of, this isn't good enough, you did this wrong, as opposed to, what a wonderful achievement. If you contrast that with the way every parent in the world reacts to the child getting up and walking for the first time,
yeah,
it is a fundamental difference. Now, I think American society is probably the best in the world and the best that has ever existed. So I want not to be saying that put downs is the end of it. I think it's one of the things that we can very easily change. And as we, and you can teach a person to change in this respect in a very short time, because everybody wants to look at the good side of things. And the key is to get skilled at that, to describe it accurately, to say accurately, here's something that we can go with. This is something we can develop. That idea of yours, I think we should talk about that for a while, because I think that could develop into something pretty
right.
special. Instead of, that won't work. The cost is, the cost of that won't work is things like the Hubble. It's things like a company turning away a product that built another company that made billions of dollars. It's the lack of imagination which says, let's not go in that direction when that was exactly the direction to go. And that, you know, history is full of examples of rejecting somebody who later went somewhere else.
That's
and
true.
Really did it.
That's very true.
And it's an, just an incredible cost.
You know, we have talked throughout our conversation, Peter, necessarily about human talents and human energies. And most of us, and I think this is pretty true of just about all of us, really, have grown up with a notion that there are certain things that are kind of given, and they can be charted, and you can be told at a very early point where you fit. And if you're told where you fit, that tells you what you're going to do. And I think the graphic representation of this is a bell curve, and you get people in the know, supposedly authorities, telling you when you're very young that, well, in my case, you know, George, you can do this, but you can't do that, and you fit right here on the bell curve and so forth. What do you think of the bell curve notion?
I have a good friend who's a writer and who took one of those tests when he was young, and he said that one thing he should not do is be a writer. You hear those stories all the time. I think the bell curve is a product of a misrepresentation of how the nervous system works. The nervous system is so structured that as adults, as 90-year-old people, we are constantly growing new neuronal material. It's very exciting. And that if you pin an IQ on somebody, that may tell you where they are at the moment they took the test, but it doesn't tell you where they're going to be 5 minutes from then when you explain a new idea and they get it. And I have seen so many examples of people taking huge jumps in their affective intelligence and becoming able to do things that other people told them they could never do. There is a woman that I saw on television recently, is one of the best percussionists in the world. She's deaf. You know, can you think of a more obvious way of judging somebody? You can't do this. So human ingenuity is incredible. And when we begin to build a realistic judgment of the capacity of people to grow, when we put them in situations and environments that stimulate that growth, there's nothing we can't accomplish. I think the key is, what is a person really committed to? What do they want to accomplish? And how can we help them do that most effectively? I live with a 9-year-old who's going to be a paleontologist. Our concern is not to make him something else. It's to put him in every situation possible where he can build that skill, as long as that's what he wants to do. At the same time, recognizing that the knowledge of music is going to help that, that the knowledge of poetry, that all the different things that make up the intellectual life will be part of that.
Well, I think that's really fascinating. I really do. I like the idea of accentuating the positive, in a sense, and helping people, you know, pursue their goals and ideas. Peter, there's so much to talk to you about. First, let me take a moment, though, just to say that this program is Dialogue. I'm George Liston, CA, and my guest today is Peter Klein, an author and educator. Peter Klein has taught extensively and trained educators at all academic levels, in government, and in the corporate sector. His most recent book is 10 Steps to a Learning Organization, which he co-authored with Bernard Saunders. Peter, I'd like to sort of shift emphasis now and go into a different direction, one that you've explored and one that's just as important as the workplace we've been talking about. And let me state it this way, just as important as making the workplace more humane and productive, clearly, is bringing the unemployed into the job market. Now, you've been doing work on this, and in fact, the city of Elkhart, Indiana, is something of a laboratory of Peter Klein's ideas in this respect. The basic project clearly is to give people a sense of their own talents, liberate their own forces, and equip them to become productive. And by way of further introduction, I was astounded to read, and I hope I've gotten this correctly, that the people, I suppose we would characterize them as hardcore unemployed, that have passed through this, women, I think, for the most part, at least in these first phases, have emerged with 54%, if I'm correct, leaving welfare roles or leaving dependency roles. And that is quite something.
That's a nice statistic. It conceals the fact that those who don't are often not, because they're going on to further education.
Oh, that's interesting, too. So it's even more positive in that sense.
Yes. This is the thing that has astonished me about this program, is that it gets the statistics get better the farther away we get from the training, because something seems to change in the individual that's permanent. And as that change has more time to manifest, you see more and more different things happening that can excite you. And fundamentally, the way it works is this. First, I'd like to give credit to the mayor, James Perrin, for coming up with this idea. He said, we in Elkhart are a city of full employment, and yet we have people on welfare. We have to go outside the city to hire people. We have people on welfare that are not taking these jobs. They're not stupid. He said, they're some of the smartest people in the city. Now, that was confirmed when they took people that were in our class and they did a focus group with them. And they said it was the best focus group in the whole city. What separates them from the rest of the workforce? One thing that I've noticed is they tend to be somewhat more committed to doing things their own way. And sometimes you can have the best ideas in the world and get fired because you're speaking up. Another thing is that often there has not been a sense that they can do it. They can, but they don't know they can. As we give them many, many experiences that help them, first of all, find out that their capacity to do is enormous. Secondly, how to negotiate modern society, because their skills that may not have been learned, such as how to do a job interview, for example. We see a very, very exciting new personality coming into being.
Building confidence, is that?
Building confidence, building competence as well.
Right.
Having a toolkit. You know, one of the things that fascinates me about Richard Feynman, the great physicist, was he said he had a different toolkit. That's what made him great. We're trying to give people different toolkits.
What do we mean by toolkits here?
Howard Gardner said we have a visual, spatial intelligence. He calls spatial means largely visual. If we learn to think visually and to record our thoughts visually, it's a new toolkit that most people don't have. Einstein had it. He was a visual and a kinesthetic thinker, and he developed the theory of relativity through manipulating that kind of structure in his mind. Only secondarily did it become logical and mathematical. As we train people how to use these intelligences that they've never used, they're developing toolkits for thinking in new and different ways.
Let me see if I've learned that, because I'm struck by that. Is this visualization? I mean, is that one of the techniques that emerges through this?
Mm-hmm. That's one of them. And one of the things that we know about the brain is that the nervous system has been designed for millions and millions of years to respond to visual images, and for only somewhere between 100,000 to a couple of million to respond to linguistic images. As you train people to do visual thinking, the richness of their language use grows enormously, because it is like a platform underneath it.
Right.
And so we have a number of different techniques. One is very simple. It's called mind mapping. It's fairly widely used, but most seminars that I teach, most of the people in them have never heard of it. And it can make a tremendous difference in the way that people process ideas quickly.
Are some of the things we talked about earlier also involved here, Peter? For example, would this group of people seeking to enter the workforce find techniques like the good and the new use to them as well?
Yes, we use all of these things. We teach them how to think for themselves, to develop a thought at length while someone else listens. We teach them how to praise one another for their achievements. We teach them how to work in teams, how to develop projects, how to set goals for themselves, all kinds of things that become very useful if you're going to be creative in the workplace.
Something you said earlier was something I wanted to ask you, but I got from you a sense that a big part of this working is community support and having, in this case, a mayor and it's kind of an enlightened system to give support to the project. Clearly, a question here that must be on the minds of anyone listening to you is the ability to replicate this elsewhere.
I'm glad you asked that.
Yeah, and asking that, let me also charge you with this. And you answer as you answer it, give us a sense also of any pitfalls or problems you've seen in this.
Okay, we have replicated in Valparaiso, in Michigan City, and in Fort Wayne. The biggest success we've had is even bigger than in Elkhart. It's in Valparaiso, Michigan City, two cities in the northwestern Indiana. The pitfalls are when it becomes a bureaucratic bone of contention. And for example, if we train people in our classroom to be extremely effective and then they go back into the welfare system and their caseworker puts them down, that undoes a great deal of what we've accomplished. It's not the end of it, but it makes it more difficult. So we are now moving into negotiating with the state as a whole to train all of their welfare workers in this. As I speak, these negotiations aren't complete yet, but we have high hopes that we'll be able to do this. And we think that everyone in the system needs to be trained to think this way.
So that the message is constantly reinforced.
Yes. And when it is harmoniously reinforced, that's when we have the best chance. It is when people undermine it, making the message inconsistent, that's where the pitfalls come in.
Yeah.
The other pitfall would be you've got to select people in such a way that you're building community in a way that makes sense. You're not going for the hardcore drug addicts first, but you're going for people who come in with a positive attitude, a desire to change, and you rely on them gradually to spread the word to more and more people so that you're working deeper and deeper into the community of unemployed and bringing more and more of them to believe that they can succeed too.
This may sound like an arcane reference on my part, but as I was reading your books, Peter, and of course enjoying this conversation, the thought occurred to me that all of this really is directed to the purpose of happiness. And it took me back actually ages. You know, Plato, I think, defined that happiness as excellence, and that in turn was the use of vital powers along lines of excellence in a life affording them scope. And it seems to me that in kind of a modern day context, that's pretty much what you're concerned with.
I don't think that there could be a better summary of it than that. Hmm. I think that the joy that you get when you've done something that is an expression of what only you can do, and you've done it as well as you possibly can, and you have no excuses, that's the highest joy that a human being can know. And I am so excited to see people tapping into that and knowing that's possible for them in carrying out the duties that they're paid to perform.
Well, Peter Klein, I can't imagine a better statement to end a conversation that I have very vastly enjoyed. I thank you so much for being with us today, and I recommend very highly your books, not just to those involved in education, but those concerned about our society. Thank you.
Thank you.
You have been listening to Dialogue. My guest today was author and educator Peter Klein. I'm George Liston, CA, producer and host of Dialogue. Assistant producer is Dennis Saunier, and our technical director is John Tyler. Dialogue is presented by APR, American Public Radio, and is a production of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars in association with Radio Smithsonian. Established by Congress in 1968, the center is our nation's official and living memorial to the 28th President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson.
For a cassette copy of this program, or for more information, call the Radio Store at 1-800-747-7444. That's 1-800-747-7444. From APR, American Public Radio.